Heart. You gotta have heart. Miles and miles of heart.
What is heart? Heart is running through a return man when the game is on the line. Heart is giving everything you have in practice, day after day. Heart is finding the strength to run down the field one more time when you can barely breathe. The heart in me pumps Husker Red.
Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of the Five Heart Podcast, brought to you by CornNation.com and hosted by JitteryMonkey.com and the Jittery Monkey family of podcasts. I am Greg Mahochko, and special surprise for all of you listeners. Usually I say I'm Greg Mahochko, joined as always by my good friend, fellow Husker fan, and longtime broadcast buddy Brian Toll. But if you've been on social media in the last 12 hours or so, you know that he is unable to join us, and we wish him the best and a speedy recovery. So we were planning a three-man conversation this week anyway, but with Brian out, I'm just thrilled to bring in my guest at this time. You know him from CornNation.com as he has been decoding the Huskers for almost a year now, I believe, or maybe right at a year, and he's been a frequent guest on probably, and I know they'll certainly say it, and I won't disagree, the number one Husker podcast out there, which is the Big Red Cobcast with Ryan Tweedy and Pat Jansen and all those other miscreants is the word we like to throw around. I say that they are the number one Husker podcast. That's no embellishment. They are the locomotive driving the Husker podcast train. And the Five Heart Podcast is like after a train heist when the villain, you know, pulls the pin. We're in that part that no longer has an engine, so we tend to fall off a little bit. But we come back as we can. Very excited that Haas Reuter is joining me. Haas, welcome to the Five Heart Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Greg. How's it going?
It's going well. It's going well. It's been a really unique week in Nebraska Cornhusker football news. Let's start with the events that happened first last Saturday. $820,000, I believe, was the number that I heard that Nebraska paid to get Northern Illinois University to come to Lincoln. And nobody expected what we saw last Saturday, Haas.
Yeah, I sure did. That's for sure. It became pretty apparent after the pick six that Lurie had. And after that, you know, the mental, it was just a real evident that we were not very mentally tough.
It seems like that has been a dilemma or an issue that has plagued Nebraska teams for a decade, would you say? I mean, we had Tommy Armstrong, who was physically tough, and you know, he came back out, jogged onto the field at the Horseshoe a year ago after being knocked out and sent to the hospital. But even when the chips were down, and I mean, Tommy's a fighter and a scrapper, but it didn't seem like focus, you know, and improvement was always there. What is it about this, you know, program over the last 10 or so years that they just haven't had that mental edge?
Well, I think a lot of it stems from a lack of, you know, physical athletic talent. It's always easier to be a little bit mentally tougher when you're physically superior to your opponent. But that's, you know, if you're more even with them in terms of talent, or you're at a talent disadvantage, that's where you got to have the mental toughness, you know, just to go out there and put the blinders on and, you know, not pay attention to the noise around you. I mean, I know that's the most coach speak, you know, you're ever going to hear on a Friday night, but we just haven't had really. You've only seen that in the 2015 Michigan State game under Riley. And before that, I mean, mental toughness, it's just not been a, you know, a hallmark of Nebraska football in the new millennium.
Would you say when we go back to the Pelini era and the win at home again, you know, at the time it was the biggest deficit ever overcome when they beat Ohio State with it, was that, I mean, that was – to me, you know, another instance where they showed a little bit of that mental grit and determination.
Yeah, I mean, kind of sparked by Levante's strip of Braxton Miller, definitely, you know, and that you need that spark to kind of really, you know, have a belief, you know, something to rally around to start coming back, you know, from a deficit like that. And before a game like that, really, I mean, you might even have to go as far back as, like, the mental toughness that the team showed under Callahan in 05, going out to Boulder and as, you know, what was it, 17-point underdogs against Colorado and winning 30-3. I mean, those are the more notable displays of mental toughness I can really think of in the post-Osborne era.
We'll put a pin in that because just before we started recording, I said, you know, I want to do a little introduction to the listeners to you. Let's hear a little bit of your background, Haas. I mean, you've got, and I don't think anybody at Coronation will dispute this, you have one of the best minds that we have as far as contributors go. And the way you see the X's and O's, and like I said, anybody who's ever, you know, clicked one of those headlines on Facebook or Twitter or Coronation.com to say decoding ... tell the listeners a little bit about yourself I don't know, maybe how well versed you are and why your passion is so much the on the field, you know, between the you know, end zone to end zone, goal line to goal line, X's and O's, really strategy football.
I'll just start from the top. Yeah, I'm a 26-year-old non-traditional student at UNO. I'm going to school to be a history teacher and a high school football coach. And I just really got interested in the X's and O's of the game ever since my dad took me to my first Nebraska game in 2002. It was against Troy State when Dewan Gross ran back two punts for a touchdown. And immediately afterwards, I thought Jamal Lord was the greatest quarterback who had ever lived. I still have an affinity for Jamal Lord even now. One tough hombre. But, yeah, I mean, it's kind of funny. Like, I was always so interested in how things worked on the football field because I think anyone who knows me will attest to this. I'm not very mechanically inclined. Anything, if it has to do with the car, I have no idea what I'm talking about. I can change tires. I can change oil. That's about it. I'm pretty limited. But as a conceptual learner with football, I mean, that's kind of where I find my niche.
So as far as the learning process that you've, you know, put yourself through, is it just, for lack of a better term, film study, or are you out there reading books from some other, you know, great coaches, things like that? That, because again, and I keep falling back on these decoding because it's kind of what you're so well known for your decoding, you know, Langsdorf's, or last year Banker, in the offseason it was decoding Diaco. You're so well known for it that other Husker sites are kind of stealing your ideas. But where did you, you know, acquire all of this knowledge?
Really starting out after I got really big into Nebraska football in 2002, just started, I had a friend of mine actually on one of the school buses in Gretna teach me how to draw football plays. And of course, in 2002, it was all short side options and quarterback keeps, and, you know, the Solich era, staples of the Solich era. And, then after that, you know, I started playing football in seventh grade, and I was just really interested in, you know, the X's and O's and everything. And then from there, you know, through high school football, you know, being an offensive lineman, you learn blocking schemes. And then, like, even now, it's kind of, you know, my Amazon order list, you know, if you go back over the past 2 years, probably about 30 or 40 football coaching books and, you know, stuff like that. And YouTube's a great resource. Twitter is a great resource. I think most of my Twitter timeline is retweets of cool plays from the weekend in college or pro football. Just a lot of reading.
And I mean, obviously, anytime it's something that you're passionate about, you know, you can, you know, read it a lot easier. I was listening to another podcast about a week ago. It was a Nerdist podcast, Chris Hardwick. I don't know if you're. I'm a nerd, so I don't know if you follow any. If you watch The Walking Dead, he's the guy who hosts the talking show after that. But he was actually talking with the son of Mel Brooks, Max Brooks, who is I don't know if he's like a bigwig in the military, aside from doing some comedy and things like that, but he's talking about reading all of these tactical strategy books and how it's like, yeah, they can be kind of boring. And I'm like, I could see how there's no narrative there. But in reading these coaches' books, obviously it's something you're very passionate about and something that you're going to be leaning on to, you know, benefit you in your career as a high school coach. I'm no Nostradamus, but I'm guessing that probably second year head coach, you're going to start putting some championship banners in the gyms of that high school, man. I'm just the knowledge that you have brought to Coronation, to the Slack chat rooms, not ever stuff that I would have ever, you know, seen or recognized. Which brings me to the topic of our next conversation, Matt Farniak, because I know that you were really high on this guy in the offseason, and you had even said if we could, you know, no disrespect to David Neville, but if we could just get Farniak at right tackle and Cole Conrad out at center, and we actually saw that situation play out against Northern Illinois, and it just did not work well for the Huskers. What happened?
A lot of it goes back to just the lack of focus and preparation. When, especially at the offensive line position, because as I said in this week's run game charting article, playing offensive line is the most unnatural phase in football. Just nothing about that position comes natural to the human body. And in order to play aggressively and confidently, you have to be focused and prepared. And we saw so many, you know, missed assignments and, you know, poor technique and not sustaining blocks. And just there's no energy along the offensive line. A lot of that just goes back to the preparation of Monday through Friday from them. And it's just really apparent that something's lacking.
I know in listening to this week's Cobcast, anybody who's listening, you should listen to the Cobcast. Everybody should. It drops usually, I think, Tuesdays on Coronation, but if you subscribe on iTunes like I do, you get it a day or two ahead. But Ryan was saying that what Nebraska needed to do, and he said what they needed to do immediately was fire Kavanaugh. Obviously, that didn't happen, and a little later in this show, we'll get into the firing that did take place. But that is, I mean, obviously, there has to be that connection between, you know, quarterback and receivers, or quarterback and running back, you know, handoffs, things like that. But there needs to be cohesion most up front. And what we saw last Saturday was no cohesion, and therefore Tanner Lee was rushed, made several bad decisions, and didn't have a whole lot of time to really evaluate the field and make good decisions.
Yeah, and a lot of that went back to we tried to adjust a few things, our pass protections, especially for, you know, to keep Lee upright. And a lot of the problems were you'd still see, you know, guys turning the wrong way, or, you know, Mikhail Wilbon would, you know, slide to take the end man on the line of scrimmage, and they would already have, you know, a running start on getting around the protection. I think it was that Sutton Smith, that one D end of theirs.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, you know, guys weren't in sync, especially a little bit more so in the running game. Pass protection-wise, they were just sending, I mean, our heads were spinning after a while, which goes back to not being adequately prepared on, you know, what they like to do in terms of their stunts and blitzes and passing situations. But, yeah, in the run game, I mean, you saw a lot of Tanner Farmer, coming off of his combo blocks with Farniak way too soon, letting a DT, you know, stuff Wilbon in the backfield. And I think there's a run, I want to say it was on the first drive, might be the third or fourth play, that Wilbon went to run to the right on the front side of a duo, gap duo play. And the whole front side was just, you know, penetrated by the D-line. He had to cut it all the way back across to the left. It's just the little thing, you know, those look like big plays, but generally, especially against a front like Northern Illinois, who were bigger, you know, and stronger than have the size and talent advantage, it's just things that are relatively simple that we're not getting done. And that goes back to, you know, coaching, focus, and preparation.
Tanner Farmer's an interesting name, and I'm glad you brought him up. He is from Highland, Illinois, which is about 15 minutes away from my hometown. So I was pretty psyched when I saw that he was going to become a Husker. Same with Vincent Valentine, who's from nearby Edwardsville. I mean, I've been through that town, you know, a bunch of times. Of course, now he's, you know, Super Bowl champion with the Patriots. But Farmer, you know, he had this Greco-Roman wrestling background. And when I learned that, the one thing that I kept thinking was going back to the 2000 movie. I think it was The Replacements. I think it was 2000. Keanu Reeves, Gene Hackman, and they're talking about bringing in this sumo wrestler to be a, you know, an offensive lineman. They're like, why would you bring in a sumo? He's like, because it's blocking, it's pass protection. So I thought that Greco-Roman wrestling experience and how he was like a national champ, you know, at 16 or 17, something like that, I thought that'd be a big help. But he just has not ever really, I don't know, met the expectations that I had. And I don't know if I had unreasonable expectations, but, you know, definitely wanted the kid to do well. And it just doesn't seem like he's quite figured it out yet.
No, I agree with you 100% on that. And, you know, when he's able to get his hands on somebody at the first level at DT in run blocking, once he's got his hands on him, you know, he's mauling him off the line of scrimmage. But if he's asked to, you know, pick up a slanting D lineman or climb up to the second level to pick up a linebacker, I don't want to be too critical of the guy, you know, but
sure.
he just struggles to, you know, be able to make those movement blocks, you know, to seal off a hole or, you know, keep, you know, a linebacker from plugging a gap. And I think he would make a better center, truth be told, you know, that kind of functional strength that mm-hmm. he has to, once he locks onto a DT, he's able to, you know, win the one-on-one battle. I think he'd make a better center, but, I mean, evidently, Cav and the powers that be have other thoughts on that.
So, aside from the Monday through Friday preparation, I mean, the on-the-field stuff, it seems like a big thing that has been a burden to the offensive line, and correct me if I'm wrong, because you're the lineman guru, and I'm not. My radio background is be like, yeah, you know, I remember going down on the field after high school games and doing post-game interviews with quarterbacks and running backs, and they always said I couldn't have done it without my O-line, which is always nice to hear, you know. But it just seems like it's a footwork thing. They can't get their feet to do what they need to do to be successful. Is that oversimplifying the issue?
No, it's just like, you know, it's just like with a car, you know, the tires are where the rubber meets the road.
Mm-hmm.
Footwork, much the same for an offensive line or offensive lineman. You know, that first step out of a stance is getting them pointed in the direction that they need to go. And then that second step is their power step. And generally, especially with, you know, against real fast attacking defensive fronts, you got to have, you know, your second step in the ground as soon as possible, because your second step is where you're going to be really generating that upward force, upward lift, you know, to get underneath of the defensive lineman and start driving it back. And a lot of the times we struggle to get those steps made before contact is initiated by the defensive lineman. And the quicker a D lineman is, the quicker that second step has to get in the ground. And, you know, we just haven't been able to do that the past, you know, well, I'd be inclined to even go as far back as saying, you know, since Dominic Raiola.
We talked right at the top of the show about mental toughness and about that pick six that ended Nebraska's opening drive last week. That looked, I'm trying to figure out the best way to say this without sounding, you know, without being accusing of anyone, but that almost looked like, you know, they had a drive chart, and because he just picked his spot. What happened there? Because he cut in, was in the backfield before the receiver was turned for the ball. I look at it from a very skeptical point of view, and I'm not, you know, obviously saying that anybody did anything wrong, but what happened on that play particularly? What broke down that allowed for him to, you know, come away free and clear with that and you know, take it back, you know, house it 90 yards later?
Well, you know, you got So Bubble Screamers to DeMornay in the inside slot position, and so he's got Stanley on the outside blocking the corner or the first color that he sees. And for Northern Illinois, they had that Shawan Lurie lined up, you know, in a press alignment over Stan. And at the snap, you know, he gets, you know, Stan doesn't even get a piece of him on the block, and Lurie's able to knife in there and pick off the pass. You know, he's off to the races. But what happened is, you know, it's kind of twofold. One, Northern Illinois was in a cover two cloud coverage where the corner is the force player on that side. So he has run responsibility to the outside, or he breaks on any outward breaking route by, you know, either of the receivers to that side. So the second he read the width step on the bubble screen by DeMornay, he gambled a little bit, mm-hmm. you know, to make that interception, but he was able to do so because, you know, being in the red zone in a condensed area, he had safety help over the top. So, you know, if it would have been like a slant bubble play, you know, and Lee decides to throw the slant to Stanley instead, it's not a touchdown. You know, it might be going down to the 2 or 1 yard line, but, you know, they're limiting the gain, all, you know, things considered. But the coverage and, you know, Lurie just making a heads-up play to jump that route or what combined for that. And a lot of people said that Lee should have handed the ball off on the inside zone portion of the play, but, you know, just kind of, you know, in the spirit of, you know, fair play here, that play likely would have been blown up. Wouldn't result in a pick six, but would have been blown up as well because of the front side penetration, you know, that occurred over Tanner Farmer and Matt Farniok.
We saw a really, going back to the Oregon game, we saw a really nice adjustment that Tanner made, and Stanley Morgan as well, to recognize it on that safety blitz, that or a corner blitz, I mean, that resulted in the touchdown. But because, as you were saying, because of the condensed field, conditions weren't right for that to have been successful if they even had time to look that way with the over-the-top help from the safety. But something better could have happened. You know, worst-case scenario, you know, this is one thing that, you know, we always hear from announcers, you know, have for 25 years or more is, hey, if it's not there, you just got to tuck it, you know. But it seemed like there was, because of the bubble screen, because it was a quick release type of design anyway, there was no time to do anything. And Lurie was there and, as we mentioned, gone to the races. But that was, when you're able to march the ball down, you know, the field like you had on that opening drive, and to have, you know, points taken off the board for you and put on, you know, for the opponent, that to me looked like a really demoralizing moment. And of course, Nebraska didn't score the entire first half, which is uncharacteristic, you know, especially at home and especially against a, you know, a MAC team. But it just didn't seem like, I don't know, their heart wasn't in it. Something was off all last week.
Yeah, I would have to agree. And that was completely different than what I thought we would see on Saturday. I thought we would have seen a team, you know, that kind of grew up a little bit in the second half of that Oregon game.
Exactly.
And then to see that effort in the first half was, you know, it was just really disappointing. And you expect more out of it. Even though I've been critical of the offensive line, I think that the baseline talent is there to be a decent offensive line. And so, you know, it's just last Saturday was a really disheartening day, all things told.
And defensively, I know we're still, you know, in the early stages of the 3-4, but the defense did hold opponents scoreless for 5 quarters, you know, until that game-winning drive on, you know, a week ago against the Huskies. What have you seen from Diaco's defense and his schemes that you have liked? And also, what have you seen that maybe you didn't like?
You know, since the second half of the Oregon game started, I've liked the fact that we're covering down on their slot, on opponent's slot receivers. You know, we're not just leaving open space there for them to throw those pre-snap bubble and hitch screens. And the defensive line, I mean, if, you know, the one unit on the team that everyone can unequivocally say is playing really well right now, even though they're, you know, not getting pressured, it's not their job, is that defensive line. Mick Stoltenberg eating up blocks in the middle. Deontre Thomas showing some really good promise for a true freshman. The Davis twins as well. But the only thing I haven't really liked, you know, is it looks like we're still trying to kind of get the hang of some coverage and, you know, coverage checks based on what the offense comes out aligned in. And then it would just be, you know, the debacle against Arkansas State, even though it's, you know, 3 weeks ago now, still kind of, you know, is a sour taste to right. give up that many years.
I'm glad you mentioned the Davis twins, Carlos and Khalil. I really thought that, you know, they had a sort of coming out party against Northern Illinois. You know, they both on the field at the same time. They were both able to be disruptive and do some nice things. And I know even though you said the conversation got heated in the Slack chat room during the game between John and somebody, one of the, I know it wasn't you, but it was somebody else, but they're, you know, saying how it's not the defensive line's job to get pressure on the quarterback, but it's to, you know, distract or disrupt the offensive lineman to allow an opportunity for the linebackers. We understand that, but it was nice to see those two monsters get in there and, you know, just doing things like knocking down a pass. I believe that happened in the first half, or, you know, get in the face, cause a disruption. I was really pleased with what I saw from Carlos and Khalil last week.
Oh, absolutely. You know, to see that from Khalil, I mean, I was saying to some of my friends I was watching the game with, you know, it's always nice when you see a second-string guy make a play like that in the game and play with some juice, you know, some energy, and show, you know, that he's gunning for that starting job, you know. The expression kind of borrowed it from the Rams offensive line coach from Hard Knocks last year. You know, he's got some dirtbag in him. You know, he plays, you know, the game, you know, pushed the limits a little bit. So it was nice to see that because, again, you know, kind of what we were saying about the offensive line, you know, being kind of lacking energy. You see that in a lot of other positions on the team too. But I think that may have been me in the Slack chat room who got heated with John about the defensive line. That sounds like it's right in my wheelhouse during the game. I think everyone watched the game with me would attest that I'm not exactly a well-adjusted individual.
I like how you used that phrase juice, and I know you've used it several times on the Cobcast. Explain to the listeners what you mean by juice, because when I hear it, I think that you can, you know, take out the word juice and put in the word fire. You know, you got that fire. Is that about the nuts and bolts of it, or is there more to the term or the phrase juice when you use it in that context?
Oh, yeah. I mean, fire and juice, they're synonymous. I just, you know, juice, you know, to me, it's like, you know, you only get 12 of football games guaranteed a year. I mean, you should be excited and just ready to rip someone's head off every game. Every Saturday, your preparation Monday through Friday should be, you know, to completely dismantle the, you know, the opponent. You only get 12 of them a year. You're doing something that people would love to do. Why not be excited?
Sure.
You know, show some, you know, show some energy and, you know, push the limits a little bit. You get a penalty like, you know, an unsportsmanlike conduct or a holding penalty or something like that. Those are effort penalties. You know, as a coach, you can live with those. You can't live with, you know, legal procedure penalties,
right,
stuff like that. But, you know, stuff that just, you know, that little extra effort, you know, that's what's been missing. You know, that and, you know, some amazing talent in the trenches on both sides of the ball, you know, at Nebraska for the past 17 years.
I like how you said, you know, the holding or, you know, those types of penalties being a little bit more forgivable because they're effort penalties, aggression
exactly.
penalties. What I learned from the last six quarters, give or take, five or six quarters, is how valuable Tre Bryant is to this offense. Because, and this is not any disrespect to Mikael Wilbon or Divine Ozigbo, who we finally, you know, found him. You know, his picture was finally taken off the back of the milk carton. But Bryant is special. And we finally had an opportunity to see that. And then, you know, just as it happened, you know, he's had this recurring injury that popped up again against Oregon. But he can do things on that field with that football that the other guys can't. And we missed that, I think, against Northern Illinois. Would it have changed the outcome? I don't know. But I think it would have made us a little bit less, you know, one-dimensional, because I really felt like at times maybe the play calling didn't have as much faith in Wilbon as I think he's capable of doing. But, they were a little pass-heavy there, I thought. And I didn't look at the stats. But Brian is someone who can do a lot of things on that football field. And I just think that with him going down with that injury, really caused us to miss him quite a bit.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in the first game against Arkansas State and then the first three quarters against Oregon, I mean, we were able to run our full complement of the running game because Bryant's just that kind of runner. He's an inside runner, an outside runner. You know, good vision, good balance. He's not exactly a top, doesn't have that, fifth gear that Amir had, hitting the open field.
Sure.
But just a solid all-around back. And then you saw after the injury, it kind of altered things, in the running game. And, no disrespect, obviously, intended towards Mikhail Wilbon, but also altered things in the pass protection game where Wilbon struggled a little. It's unfair to say he struggled, entirely in pass protection, because there are some times where three guys broke through, he's only able to pick up one. But Bryant is just such a stalwart pass blocker that you just can't get back soon enough.
Well, let's talk about the events that took place the tail end of this week. On Thursday, we learned that in the near future, we're going to have a new athletic director, as Sean Eichhorst was fired. How do you think it was handled as far as one of the regents, Ronnie Green? Is that a regent job to make that call, or at least make that announcement? But what do you think that means for not just the football program, but Husker athletics in general?
Well, I think it shows that Nebraska is not content just to, continue with the state of affairs of the men's athletic teams right now, football, basketball, and baseball being what they are. And I think it sends a message that, with top-down leadership in an athletic department, you got to go out and get, a top-flight AD. Nebraska had their pick of the litter with ADs with Bill Byrne, in taking over for Devaney in the 90s. And I just think you have to have that strong leadership. And not saying, that I thought I liked Sean Eichhorst personally, but I just think that, they must have felt like there was something endemically inside the athletic department that needed to be addressed. And I'll be curious to see, where this leads for the fortunes of the Big Three, Nebraska, or football, basketball, and baseball going forward.
I would almost venture to say, and no disrespect to basketball, I'd almost say that the Big Three at Nebraska, I don't want to exclude anybody. We know football is one, but I would almost say that volleyball has to be in there as well, as far as, the one of the bigger, more marquee programs that the university has, because and this was raised. See, Tweety, Pat, I do listen, because I remember you guys saying that this is, it might be one of the only women's athletic programs that's self-sustainable in the country, outside of maybe UConn women's basketball. The Nebraska women's volleyball program, they don't necessarily need money from the football team, all the money that brings in. But I'm in agreement with you. Here's, a lot of the debate going now is, do you get a Nebraska guy, or do you, get just the best out there? I don't want you to, do any drafting or anything like that, but do you have a short list of names you'd like to see take over?
I'd really like to see Chris Del Conte, who, Brian mentioned that article from yesterday from Texas Christian. And Bernard Meir from Stanford's another name I think we should look at. And obviously, the you know, Bernard Meir from Stanford. It's a little bit for selfish reasons if we have to make a change with Riley. David Shaw is basically my favorite college football coach currently right now. So I'd be totally cool with that, obviously.
Yahoo Sports had an article out, I believe. If it wasn't Friday, it was late Thursday, saying that Nebraska's not, you know, the destination job anymore. I don't know if they were talking football, or I think it was because of the I-Corps firing. I believe it was, you know, athletic department or athletic director. How much, if it's not seen as a top tier, you know, again, nationally, we're homers, so, you know, still, you know, number one in our programs, number one in our hearts. But if it's not, if it doesn't have that type of, I don't know, vision or spotlight on it, you know, that shine that it had certainly 20 years ago, how much money would it cost to get, you know, someone from Stanford if it's seen maybe not even as a lateral move, but in some eyes maybe seen as a downgrade going from Stanford to Nebraska? And I don't say that to be blasphemous, fans. I'm just saying if the perception is that Nebraska is not a, you know, top tier job, destination job anymore, then maybe, you know, some people consider Stanford that job. And in that case, how much money do we have to throw at them to get them over, you know, from the Pac-10?
Well, are we talking like AD or football coach?
We'll go AD right now. I mean, I think football coach probably is going to end up making a little bit more because they get a little bit more spotlight. Yeah. But I mean, do you have to throw, and I don't need a specific number, but do you have to throw a considerable amount of money to get someone from, you know, being established at Stanford to leave there and go to Lincoln? It, because it's, again, that perception is that Nebraska is not that top-tier program anymore.
Yeah, I think you do. I think you got to offer every incentive. A lot of people think that it's not that top-tier program anymore, but it can be.
Oh, sure.
It's just a matter of redefining, you know, kind of, I don't want to say redefining core values because, you know, core values in a place like Nebraska are, you know, near and dear, you know, to the hearts and minds of the good people of the state. But, you know, just redefine, you know, what are we going to stand for, you know, as an athletic department? You know, what kind of culture, you know, good communication amongst all the different, you know, athletics programs and clear and consistent expectations. And I think that, you know, you throw a lot of money at someone, you know, like Chris Del Conte or Bernard Meir. And then from there, you know, you, with your athletics coaches, you know, you spend, you know, spare no expense bringing on, you know, coaches into the program. And it's just one of those things that you have to offer that incentive because as much as I love Nebraska football and Nebraska athletics, it's one of those things that it's not, you know, in the minds of a lot of people around here and in a lot of coaches' minds as well, the expectation to win is already high enough.
Right.
But there's also the expectation that you have to win a certain way, which obviously, you know, from the conversations in the Slack room, you know that I have a different take on, you know, the winning a certain way, but which might be considered blasphemous, you know, to a lot of people. But I just think that because there are some headaches, you know, that accompany, you know, a job like Nebraska, of much that is given, of much is expected. You know, I think I butchered that saying pretty badly, but I hope the point got across still.
Is it because, you know, for lack of a better term, the Huskers are the only game in town? I mean, you got the Chiefs who are nearby. You got the Broncos who are not so much. I mean, Minneapolis, you know, things like that. But you know, the Vikings. But as far as football goes, I mean, there's no other school in the state that has football. There's another school to the northeast a little bit that may or may not play basketball once in a while. And I know we've got some people who root for the Big Red in the fall and then switch allegiances, which I've never quite understood.
I am the Jasker in the coordination staff. I admit that.
Is the expectation high or maybe the pressure high because it's the only game in town because, you know, they did used to win an awful lot back in the day, or, you know, a combination of everything? And what is going to be the new expectation? I mean, 9 wins with Pelini wasn't enough, you know. What's the new expectation? Because we're not going to win a conference championship this year, I don't think. I'd love to be proven wrong. What's a realistic expectation for this football program?
You know, going forward, I think, you know, this year notwithstanding, I think a reasonable expectation is that you win the division 3 out of every 5 years. And, you know, you get to Indianapolis and you give it hell against whoever, you know, comes out of the East. And I think as long as you have an identity and a culture, identity, and a scheme that you recruit to and you coach really well, I think that those expectations take care of themselves eventually. Nebraska, for the first, 17 years of this new millennium, have been a little bit too, we've been a little bit too obsessed with writing the last sentence of the book and expecting whatever coaching staff to get to the end of that book writing their own story, but it has to align with our conclusion.
Sure. You know,
we're demanding that it's done a certain way. We just need to hire the best out there and let them do their jobs, recruit and coach what they know. And I think the rest takes care of itself and the expectations become self-sustaining after a while.
I'm going to ask a very difficult question that I don't think I've ever asked anybody individually from coordination before. So congratulations, you're the first. Can Mike Riley get us back to that championship level?
National championship or conference championship?
I think right now we would just like a trophy that's not $5 and bits of broken chair, although I'm thrilled to see that that's coming back. So let's just go conference. Can Mike Riley deliver a conference championship? Question mark.
Well, I think he can get us a division championship. And so from there you can extrapolate it out. You get to Indy, you give it your best shot.
Right.
But I will say, you and others in the Slack room know I'm a Mike Riley guy.
Yeah, as am I.
I think after last Saturday it kind of went from, Riley, I could see us in the playoff under Riley at some point too. I came to the kind of the stark realization, Mike Riley's not the guy to get us back to national prominence. And that's okay. Because we gotta play the long game here and, restocking the roster and turning over the culture and kind of pouring a good solid foundation. But let's just say he coaches, until through the 2019 season. Let's say he retires at a nice round number of 5 years, being here in Nebraska. Whoever takes that job after Riley is the guy who will get us back to national prominence, because he's going to have a nice, healthy culture in place. He's going to have a roster that's stocked with talent. And we're going to have our pick of the litter because we didn't do something stupid like fire a coach, with a knee-jerk reaction.
Sure. It seems like Husker fans are impatient. And
look,
it's like, hi, I'm Captain Obvious.
I am too. Like, I'm able to, by the end of the season, I'm like, we are what we are. Okay. Through winter conditioning, spring ball, the optimism ramps up. By about 4th of July, I'm usually at my family's get-together, and I'm talking to one of my cousins about how we're going to win the whole damn thing. I've just convinced myself that everyone's all of a sudden hit 99 in the ratings, like on NCAA football.
Yeah.
And then about October of each year, I realized that, passion for a team is a hell of a drug.
I guess where I'm going with that is, because I know patience is a virtue. I'm not always most patient. I try to be patient, especially with something like Nebraska football, because I have zero control over it. So the question that I have, not just for you, Haas, but for any listener, out there of our dozens of listeners that we've got here at the Five Heart Podcast, would you sacrifice just a couple more years of Mike Riley as far as him being our head coach, like you said, riding out his contract and retiring, and building that positive culture, that good Nebraska culture, you know, stocking the cupboards for the next coach to be in the playoff in 2020-2021. I don't want to say risk reward, but is the patience worth the payoff? Or does it have to be, no, we want to win it in 2018, you know?
I think it's worth the patience is worth the payoff in that case. And that's assuming that things don't bottom out.
Oh, sure.
Under Riley, you know, for the rest of 17, 18, and 19. You know, if it's, you know, 7, 8, 9 wins, you know, maybe, you know, one of those years we get to Indy, you know, that it's totally worth the payoff, you know, continue to, you know, keep stock in the cupboards. And then, you know, 2 years in college football, you know, it seems like an eternity. You know, the 15 season seems like it was in the Stone Age now looking back on it. But, you know, a lot can change. And I think if we just continue to, you know, kind of keep our heads down and just diligently work at, you know, rebuilding this program, just kind of like the old tired, worn out saying, Rome wasn't built in a day. I think that the payoff is definitely worth it.
So today, game day, Rutgers, you know, it's a brand new season, so to speak. And theoretically, Nebraska could win out the rest of their schedule, go to Indianapolis and, you know, cause havoc, wreak havoc and let slip the dogs of war, if you want to get classic literature or whatever the hell that origin, you know, is.
I like it.
Thank you. The Scarlet Knights are in town. I mean, it's Rutgers, and for a long time, you know, everybody's been laughing at Rutgers, but this is a Nebraska team that has lost to Illinois. This is a Nebraska team that lost to Purdue and struggles with Iowa and lost to Northern Illinois. So, you know, Nebraska is not too far off the, you know, I hate to say it, but they're just not far off, you know, being the laughing stock themselves. So what needs to happen against Rutgers, you know, besides a win? I mean, we were hoping, you know, for dominance against Northern Illinois. It didn't happen. So realistically, what needs to happen today to, you know, start turning things around?
Well, I think first, you know, got to play clean and efficiently on the offensive side of the ball, and just no drive-killing penalties, or, you know, just execute assignments, which with a true freshman right tackle, even as good as Brendan Hymus, I'll be really interested to see, you know, how that works out. And, you know, just playing it one play at a time. That, I mean, as trite as that sounds, just controlling, you know, everything we can, and just, I mean, this sounds like, was it from Bull Durham when Kevin Costner teaches Tim Robbins all the cliches to speak in? But, yeah, I mean, like, honestly, we just got to play our brand of football, like as we prepare to do Monday through Friday.
And hope that the things that, you know, have happened that are beyond the realm and control of these student athletes is not a distraction as they move forward. I mean, their focus, you know, as far as football goes, needs to be on football, and they can't worry about, you know, who's going to be their next, you know, AD or anything like that. They have two jobs. I always say this because, you know, I do believe in the student part of student athlete. They've got to, you know, take care of business in the classroom and take care of business on the field or in other sports, the court, you know, the sand, you know, the diamond, whatever. So yeah, with proper preparation, what do we need to see from Tanner Lee? Cause we haven't talked a whole lot about him today. There's something that needs to happen, because right now he is as advertised as he was 2 years ago coming over from Tulane. He's not the, you know, the NFL hopeful that we all thought he'd be in the offseason. What does Tanner need to do to keep the past in the past and not worry about, you know, having shadows from Northern Illinois and Oregon?
Well, Just really, he kind of needs to be a little quicker on knowing when to get out of the pocket, you know, especially if pass protection is going to still be problematic. A lot of times against Oregon, there were, you know, 5, 7, 10 yards, you know, available if you just went, tucked it, and ran. And that's one, you know, one area I'd like to see him improve a little bit at. And then a lot of it's just, you know, not holding on to the ball, you know, too long. Then also there have been times that he trusts his arm a little bit too much to fit the ball into some pretty tight windows. So just to, you know, play with himself, you know. You're not, you know, some guys might be tempted to start pressing. It's just, you know, every pass that he makes, it's not going to change the outcome of the Oregon or Northern Illinois game. You just got to put it out of your mind, you know. And you just got to play it loose.
What are you expecting to see from Rutgers? Because, you know, we, as far as previews go, I mean, what do you know about them, and what do you think that they're going to bring to the field?
Well, first off, with Jerry Kill being their offensive coordinator, you're going to see a pretty disciplined offense. You know, they're not going to beat themselves with turnovers or penalties. And, you know, they're going to be content to line up and punch you in the mouth. You know, it's going to be a lot like kind of those Mitch Leidner Minnesota teams under Jerry Kill. And then, you know, defensively, I'm a little bit concerned with their coverage. You know, Chris Ash, who was at Ohio State under Urban Meyer, he runs a lot of, you know, different coverages that, you know, well, let's face it, Lee hasn't exactly shown the greatest coverage recognition, you know, so far this year. So, we might get snookered a few times, you know, baited into some throws.
Prediction?
We're going to win. I think it's going to be ugly. I'm going to go 28-13.
All right, I'll take it. I also like to see a big red W. I don't want to see the fans holding on to the balloons at halftime still, so hopefully we can get on the scoreboard early and often, just like voting in Chicago, it's early and often. That's a downstate Illinois joke for you folks from Nebraska. That's a long story. Long political story going back to the Daley era of Chicago. So anyway, Haas, I want to thank you for spending some time talking with me here on the Five Heart Podcast, and I know we miss Brian and wish him a speedy recovery, but thanks for filling in and bringing your wisdom, and we might be calling on you again down the road, because it's always a good time talking with you, buddy.
Thanks for having me on. You know, anytime you want to have me back, you know, I'll be more than happy to have an appearance.
Yeah, and you know, next time you're on the Cobcast, just tell him how much I talked him up, because you know, the stats are numbers don't lie, and I know that Pat and Tweety aren't listening to my show, so tell them that I talk them up. I'm always very positive about what I say about the Big Red Cobcast, and I anybody here listening to the Five Heart Podcast, you should listen to the Big Red Cobcast, although I will say, Haas, their language tends to be a little saltier than what to find here at the Five Heart Podcast.
You know, I think we got through the entire show without dropping a single F-bomb or really any obscenity of any kind. Usually it's in the first 5 minutes with the Cobcast boys.
And if Brian were here, that wouldn't be the case. He's our big swear. But I want to thank you again. Thanks again to Haas. And, hey, if you enjoyed the big let me rephrase. If you enjoyed the Five Heart Podcast, make sure that you hit that like button on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Check us out, of course, coronation.com, jitterymonkey.com for a few other podcasts that we do, including my other podcast, which is all about comics, movies, pop culture stuff. It's called Nerds United. You can check that on iTunes and Stitcher. There's also pro wrestling podcasts. Haas, do you like pro wrestling?
As a kid, I did. Ric Flair is still a personal hero of mine.
Hey, he kicked out at two as well. He's still with us. Check out this is Haas if you're interested. Otherwise, anybody else, check out my 123 cents, the podcast. And then if you're 26, so you were born in 1991, weren't you, Haas?
90. I'll be 27 90. This November.
Okay. So you don't remember 1991 in music, but over at Positive Cynicism, they used 3 episodes in about 3.5 hours, and they broke down the music from 1991, from rap and hip hop to country to grunge to hair metal, if it was music, if it made headlines in 1991, they were talking about it. Check out Chad Smart at Positive Cynicism. Folks, my name again, Greg Mahochko. Thanks to Hoss Reuter for joining me, and you can check out his stuff. Coronation.com, just search for decoding, and you'll be met with a litany of brilliance, the best way that we can describe it. And Hoss, you're also on Twitter?
Yes, at Hoss Reuter.
That's R-E-U-T-E-R, easy to remember. Hoss Reuter, thanks so much again to Hoss. And again, quick note and shout out to Brian Toll, who he's not with us this week, but we know he's going to be watching the game, and wish him a speedy recovery. And my name is Greg Mahochko. This has been the longest outro ever in the Five Heart Podcast history, but hope you enjoyed it and enjoy the show. And reminding you this week and every week that Five Heart is all the heart you need. Go Big Red.
Go Big Red.
This is a production of the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network. For more jittery shenanigans, go to jitterymonkey.com.